final speaker on our program is Dr. Marty Edelman, who began our conversation by discussing the controversial issue of chemoradiation therapy for stage 3 disease, and specifically new findings reported at ASCO by Dr. Nasser Hanna and the Hogg Group.
The trial from the Hoosier Oncology Group with docetaxel as consolidation is very intriguing and sobering, you know, and shows that it's important to do, you know, the phase 3 trials before one runs off with phase 2 data, no matter how promising. You know, it's certainly a disappointing result. I think the implications for practice are quite interesting because, to me, there are two kind of generally accepted approaches to chemoradiation in stage 3 lung cancer. And one was the Southwest Oncology Group approach, a la 9504, with full-dose platinumetoposide radiation, and then following that with the consolidation docetaxel. And clearly that approach, the consolidation part, is called into question. We'll get back to that in a moment. And the other approach has been the low-dose chemoradiation, a la RTOG and the LAMP trial, of low-dose carboplatinum taxol with consolidation, full-dose carbotaxol. So I think that the latter approach, where you're using a consolidation regimen, remains viable in this. I think that the full-dose chemoradiation also is certainly viable. Whether you should use docetaxel at this point or some other consolidation really is unclear, and I have to admit, I think it's a really hard decision. I mean, I haven't quite reached a conclusion in my own mind about that. I mean, we've used the low-dose carbotaxol and consolidation approach, and that's been successful, and I think, you know, we have long-term data on that, but it is something one has to wonder about.
Maybe we can dissect that out a little bit, and we could talk a little bit about the design of the Hogg trial and sort of how their data has been rolling out over the last couple of years, and also the issue of toxicity, events, et cetera. How do you put that all together?
Well, the basic idea behind the Hogg trial, and, you know, sort of back up, because I think you have to understand this in terms of the Southwest Oncology Group studies, was that they had a study in the early 90s of platinumetoposide radiation, and then that's followed by more platinumetoposide. And then a few years later, there was SWOG 9504, led by Dave Gandara. Phase 2 study, I think, if memory serves me, 83 patients. And in that trial, there was an outstanding, this was only for stage 3B patients, so there was an outstanding result that held up over the years. And there's no question of its reality. This was a cooperative group study. You know, you get the data. The data's handed to you. You know, you're not going out there and shifting through charts. And this showed this, what was it, almost 30-plus percent five-year survival. It was really quite outstanding and very doable in a cooperative group setting. So the logical follow-up would have been to randomize these two approaches and see really what was the actual value of docetaxel in this setting versus platinum and cisplatinum and etoposide. And I believe that that was actually proposed by SWOG, but at that point there was much ado about EGFR inhibition, as there remains. And so this was sort of returned to them with the idea that, yes, we like this, and if you do a large enough study, you'll validate that arm. But we really are interested in seeing just what ERISA will do, gefitinib will do as a maintenance therapy. And I'll get to that, because that to me is the other really important study that's out there. And
that was the 0023 study.
SWOG 023 of Karen Kelly's. And so Hogg picked this up, and what they really did was ask a question of consolidation versus no consolidation. So it's not a question of docetaxel versus something else. It's yes or no. And at the end of the day, what came out of this was that docetaxel certainly added some significant toxicity, and there was no survival benefit. And, you know, was this study relatively small? Yes, it was, but certainly there was no opportunity for this to have been positive, and that's the result.
What about the issue of toxicity, and did patients actually get the treatment?
Well, there were, I forget exactly what number got docetaxel versus, you know, and how many cycles they did. To me, that's not a really material issue. I mean, if you can't get a treatment, then you can't receive any benefit from it if it's too toxic or,
although
you know,
if you take all comers, it's one thing. But right. If you select people who maybe are younger and better conditioned to be able to handle the treatment, would you see something different?
Well, we don't know that. We don't know that. And that's obviously speculative. But, you know, this is stage 3 patients in a, you know, reasonable group that does reasonable trials in the United States. And I think this was a reflect of the populations. Now, one difference, and I don't remember what it was in the Hoosier group, but many of the SWOG trials have a minimum FEV1 of 2 liters, and this was pointed out, and I think this is very important as one compares. So as one then, let's transition to 0023, where you have this 19-month median survival if you take the entire study population. So that's an excellent survival. That certainly validates this whole approach is being reasoned. That includes both the randomized arm and the non-randomized arm.
Could you
arm.
Just kind of track okay. into the design of that
okay.
study?
Just so, that, so that study had patients with 3A or 3B. They got platinum etoposide radiotherapy to 61 gray. And then this was followed by docetaxel 2 to 3 cycles. And then they got gefitinib or placebo. And so over the last few years, this has kind of rolled out as gefitinib kind of got off the market. And there was this thought, should this study continue? And the original breakout of the data was kind of surprising because it showed that, if anything, the gefitinib arm was doing actually somewhat worse than the control arm.
Of course, now, it was a totally unselected population.
It was an unselected population of patients. And as what's happened with this study is, as time has gone on, so a couple of points come from this. One is, if you just consider both arms together, there's a fairly good survival. Median survival is 19 months on this trial, and that's certainly good and competitive with anything else. Realizing, of course, that in these studies, the FEV1 that was allowed for this is very different from those from many of the RTOG, CLGB, and other trials, which have generally been about 1.2 liters.
You're talking about the SWOG study?
SWOG study. So SWOG study had a somewhat better performing group of patients to start with. But what's astonishing about this study, I mean, that's somewhat tangential, but what's astonishing is that the gefitinib arm does spectacularly worse than the control arm, and that P is now 0.01. It's actually gotten more striking over the years. And this is not due, you know, whenever we see this, it's always, oh, well, they get the toxicity. Well, nobody's dying from gefitinib, okay? I mean, the number of deaths due to gefitinib in North America are very small. And Karen Kelly analyzed this very carefully, and this was not due to excessive chemotherapy-related deaths. These were due to cancer. So what we're seeing here is something that I believe is an important theme of many studies in both so-called targeted therapy as well as in even good old-fashioned drugs like platinum, which is, if you don't have the marker for susceptibility, whatever that may be, you actually, it's not that it's just a break-even affair a lot of times. These patients frequently will do worse. So for example, here you have gefitinib. These patients didn't just break even or maybe have some toxicity. Their cancer actually returned faster or was more aggressive than the others. So let's look at a completely different situation, which also shows somewhat of a similar sort of issue, which is platinum with ERCC1. So recently we've seen adjuvant data presented that the IELTS study, New England Journal publication, where you had patients who did not express ERCC1, DNA repair enzyme, important for repair of platinum-induced DNA damage. Those patients clearly got a benefit that was much more significant than the population as a whole versus control.
ERCC1 is in the tumor.
Is in the tumor, okay. On the other hand, and the other curve was for those who actually overexpress ERCC1 in the tumor, those patients, though it's not statistically that different, certainly it is numerically different. The hazard ratio is a 14% worse outcome. And again, it's not due to toxicity. It's due to a worse cancer outcome. These patients, when they die, if you look at those curves, they separate after about 6 months or so. So the way that I'm interpreting this, and there are a number of other trials that are sort of similar to this now, and we had a similar situation in CLGB with celecoxib and COX-2 expressing and non-expressing tumors, where if the target is present, then the drug, the targeted therapy, be it a traditional target, DNA, RNA, or the various enzymes, et cetera, that govern whether or not you can repair that, or the target now for the specifically targeted therapies, that these patients will do better, while those who do not express or overexpress the negative factor not only don't break even, they actually do worse.
And, you know, it'd be one thing if, let's say, the gefitinib was given during the chemotherapy, which it was not in 0023. So it wasn't
right.
sort of
this was not antagonism.
Okay. So, yeah. I mean, again, from my sort of simplistic point of view, I'll say, okay, this would be like giving Herceptin to people who are HER2 negative.
Mm-hmm.
But why would they do worse?
Well, that remains the great mystery in this. And Mark Green was the discussant and hypothesized this could lead to MET overexpression, and that in turn would be
MET over?
MET, yeah. It's an oncogene, another growth factor. And in one of the scientific sessions, Passiani's group has described this as a mechanism for emerging resistance to the EGFR inhibitors. So there are a number of possibilities. I think that, and I'm not a tumor biologist, but my approach of looking at this is that these drugs affect the various cellular growth factors and pathways, you know, one way or the other. And if the tumor is driven by a particular pathway and you inhibit that, that's good. If, on the other hand, it's not, you may actually be perturbing a pathway and leading to a worse outcome. And I think this is something that's going to need an extensive amount of research. I think from the practical point of view of that of the everyday practicing oncologist, what I would say is to take these new drugs and this new data and view it very cautiously. You know, so for example, the tendency now of saying, oh, we have a patient, they're doing well, I'm going to give this as a consolidation or a maintenance because it's easy to take and it's an anti-cancer drug and how bad can it be? This has clearly shown that this can actually produce a worse outcome. And one should, I think, stick very reasonably close to the evidence in the day-to-day practice of medicine.
Okay, so let's get into a specific clinical situation. So obviously using it exactly as in the trial in the stage three setting following, you know, chemoradiation therapy, that's pretty evident that that is a strategy shouldn't be used. I don't think many people are using it. What about the use of erlotinib in metastatic disease and the algorithm that most people have in terms of using it as part of a second-line option and considering smoking status and if you happen to have an EGFR status and making those decisions? Do you think those kinds of decisions should be made differently now because of this?
No, I think that's a completely separate question. I mean, in one situation, you have almost maximal reduction of disease. You're treating in a curative status. It's just a completely different situation than the decision of second, third-line erlotinib.
Also, I think, I mean, you should be able to get a clinical gauge of what you're doing here because you have evident disease.
The patient's right in front of you. And, you know, one should recognize that erlotinib, it's a fascinating drug to use because we have this idea that there's these women, non-smokers, never smokers who have adeno with BAC features. And, you know, these people come into my office now with increasing frequency. And despite the fact that it seems like it's been hard to demonstrate that these numbers are really increasing, though there's a little bit of epidemiologic evidence. I mean, I'm seeing 2 to 3 never smokers a month in my clinic. I mean, they're there and they're increasing.
What about oligosmokers? Do you approach them the same way, you know, less than 15?
Yeah, I mean, the people that are from, you know, years ago, smoked for 1 year and stuff, and we just see an increasing number of these patients.
Incidentally, on a national level, I've heard guesses of maybe as high as 20% if you include never and oligo. Does that sound right? Or is that?
I think that's probably a little high. And then, of course, there's the question, what about the person who smoked for 5 or 10 years and quit 40 years ago?
I'm talking about.
Well, but there's almost two different groups there because there's the people who are less than 100 cigarettes in their lifetime.
Oh, okay.
Then there's these long-term quitters and stuff. And,
well, the number I've seen, Memorial's use is less than 15 pack years. That's what I would call an oligo smoker.
Again, there's the 100 cigarettes, the pack year cigarette, you know, and stuff of those are sort of almost the never smokers. So there have been somewhat differing definitions, but yeah, I mean, the overall numbers are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000 patients
That's
per year.
That's a lot of people.
Right. I mean, if you look at this and the statistic there is that this is actually an incidence that exceeds that of myeloma or ovarian cancer.
And, you know, for example,
this is a major disease.
And, you know, HER2-positive breast cancer, you're looking at 35,000, 40,000 cases, too. So it's kind of in the same ballpark. But, okay, so and I want to track out where you are right now with your metastatic disease algorithm, but just to complete in terms of the practical clinical applications. We've talked about stage 3. We've talked about metastatic disease. What about the trials that are looking at an adjuvant use of erlotinib in enriched populations? Do you think there's any reason to be concerned about putting patients on studies like that?
No. I think that if you have an enriched population where you feel that the marker, either from the epidemiology or because you're actually testing this in a population, I think that's a reasonable approach. We clearly need to approach the use of these drugs in a much more intelligent fashion, and I think that that's the way to do it. And I think that would be a very reasonable thing, particularly, I mean, obviously in a resected population, you know, you can test for the presence of EGFR by FISH or for the mutation or whatever your favorite methodology is. I mean, I'm not one of the EGFR doyens, but the thing is that that's an important question, and this study 0023 does not answer that question.
So you have no concerns about putting people in trials like that?
No.
Just as long as we got into it, one of my favorite questions is if you, assuming you were a non-smoker who had the mutation, you know, line up every possible enrichment factor, we're in an adjuvant situation, would you want to take erlotinib after chemotherapy?
No, because I still don't think that things are there. And I think that because of this, I mean, would I be willing to perhaps enter on a trial or at least discuss that? I think that that's important. And I think it's not so much what a patient wants. I think there's an obligation in medicine to educate people. And a patient can come in with a preconceived idea of what they read in a newspaper. I think it's up to physicians to sit there and be knowledgeable about the greater view of the world, including some knowledge of statistics, some knowledge of trials, and some appreciation for the fact that anecdote is nice, but that's not the way that one should ultimately drive your practice. That really, when you have evidence that indicates that there's a possible danger and no evidence to support this in that setting, I think one should be extremely cautious about the use of an expensive drug that does have toxicities. You know, the fact that we grade, and this is one of my pet peeves, you know, it's interesting. If you look at the CTC adverse event criteria version 3.0, you have 24,000 platelets, which never hurt anybody, and that's a grade 4 toxicity. If you have rash that covers half your body, that's a grade 2 toxicity. So I think the grading is nonsense. I mean, I see these patients constantly. You know, I have hundreds of patients, and the patients who are on Tarceva get some fairly significant toxicities. I mean, are these necessarily life-threatening? Usually not. ILD is pretty uncommon in the United States, but they are significant, symptomatic, very visible toxicities.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how people answer my question now as opposed to how they would have answered a few days ago. You know, when I think about it, certainly, in terms of guidelines and stuff, mm-hmm. that's another issue. But in individual people, you know, I don't know. I think it would be kind of attractive to think about taking it. But certainly, it can maybe a little bit more reservation today than a few days ago. Let's get back to the HOG study, because we started mm-hmm. out with that. And maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of how you're putting this together and what you think the implications are in terms of actual clinical practice.
Like I said, I think the biggest issue here is, do you need any consolidation therapy if you have given full-dose chemotherapy with concurrent radiation in stage 3? And I think at the moment, the evidence is against doing that. I think that this is different from the situation with the alternative, you know, sort of the major competing approach, which is that emerged out of the LAMP study from the American College of Radiology, and which has been used by the RTOG and some of the cooperative groups, of low-dose carboplatinum Taxol with radiation, followed by a couple of courses of consolidation chemotherapy. The latter is what we've tended to do at University of Maryland the last few years, and we've sort of built around that approach. I don't think that that is an analogous situation. I think, however, that with chemo radiation, it certainly now is a reasonable thing to do, to use just full-dose chemotherapy and radiation and not consider the consolidation. Having said that, it is difficult, as one is now in this era of adjuvant chemotherapy, right, that if these were stage 3, if this was a somewhat earlier 3A patient who was resected, we'd give them 4 courses of full-dose chemotherapy, you know, which would be platinum-based. So I have to say, this is something that I just don't yet have reached a final conclusion in my own mind. I mean, I don't think I'm comfortable almost with either approach of doing this.
Yeah, if you kind of separate out the local issues and the systemic sort of mm-hmm. adjuvant type issues, and I hear your concern that maybe it's not adequate sort of adjuvant type therapy, you know, that sort of makes sense. What do you think you're going to do in your own practice? You've been using 9504.
No, we haven't.
So we're not doing that.
And so I think we'll probably continue with the approach that we have had over the years. Maryland has tended to be very aggressive in its approach to these patients surgically as well. And so we've been able to use this. We don't have the experience with the cisplatinum-based regimens in that setting.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other things that have happened here. And the other thing that jumps out is the AVAIL study. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what that looked at and what they've reported?
So this is really a confirmatory study of the ECOG 4599 of looking at cisplatinum, gemcitabine, with bevacizumab either at 7.5 or 15 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks. And the preliminary results of this were presented. So this was presented in terms of progression-free survival, responses, and toxicities, but not yet the overall survival statistics. So Dr. Manigault presented this. And It was interesting because it really confirmed very nicely the results of 4599. But what was interesting is that the PFS, at least, was identical between the 7.5 and the 15 arms. And I think that...
So could you clarify the design of the study?
So it's a randomized trial, stage 3B, 4 disease, randomizing the patients between cisplatin gemcitabine, bevacizumab 7.5 milligrams per kilogram, and cisplatin gemcitabine bevacizumab 15 milligrams per kilogram.
And the eligibility? Same as 4599,
pretty
much.
Very similar eligibility to my recollection.
Non-squamous, et cetera.
Yeah, I think they excluded the non-squames. I don't remember the issue with brain mets with them. I can't recall whether they allowed anticoagulation or not. And what they found was really very similar results, you know, improvement in the progression-free survival very nicely. What was interesting was that men and women did exactly the same. But again, one should remember that that was also true on 4599, that it was the overall survival where you had that interesting disparity in the sexes. Response rates also were improved. But it seemed that the toxicity was much less than what was seen on 4599. And that, to me, was very surprising. There was not the sharply increased risk of neutropenic fever that was seen in the final publication from 4599. There seemed to just be less bleeding, less problems.
Hemoptysis.
There was hypertension. There was very little hemoptysis, as I recall.
I don't know that you could indirectly say, you know, those small numbers, that'd be a difference. Could you?
No, but there was just not in the 4599. I mean, one is comparing in the AVAIL study, you have still fairly large numbers of patients, and yes, those numbers are small, but this was a fairly significant increase in 4599, and that signal was just not there in this. And so maybe it's the regimen, maybe it's just some noise in the universe. And the other fact is it might also be some degree of data capture. I mean, you know, these were preliminary results, and if one thinks back to the original presentation of 4599, many of those toxicity reports kind of showed up somewhat later, and the final publication, in fact, had substantially more issues of neutropenic fever than, as I recall, originally presented.
Now, the dose thing is very interesting.
Yes.
But now,
yes.
Were they able in the design and the statistics to try to compare the two doses?
No, no.
It was
this
really the
not,
two doses
this is,
versus
yeah,
nine.
This is, you can't go, so if you have arms A, B, C, it's comparing, you know, C to A, B to A, but not B to C. So you really can't directly compare it. However, this is one of those areas where I think, I mean, I'm a great believer in evidence-based medicine. On the other hand, this is a guide, not a jail. And, I mean, in this situation, a certain degree of common sense should prevail after AVAIL, which is that if in the final paper, even now, I think that the 7.5 looks as good as 15, and it's obviously substantially less expensive, and one would have to consider switching to that.
So are you considering that?
Yeah.
Interesting. What were you going to say to patients when you talk about this then? Or are you going to bring it up to the patient?
No, I don't think the individual dosing issue of something is... I mean, the use or non-use of a drug and its toxicities is one thing, but, you know,
but I mean,
which
it,
dose
it,
I'm going to select is...
But I mean, if your thinking on this is driven by economics, is that the main issue?
Well, I think that if there's no difference between in two doses, why would you choose a higher dose?
Well, because maybe there's a difference that you can't see, I guess.
If it's not there in survival, progression-free survival, or response, what's the difference?
Do you think that the power is there to compare those two arms?
No. I mean, obviously, they didn't have that large number, but I think that, again, it's quite amazing how these are just superimposable. If anything, the 7.5 arm did numerically better.
So,
it wasn't like they were slightly, you know, less.
So are you also going to do this if you use other regimens with Bev, specifically carbotaxel? Or just if you're using it with gemcitabine?
I would certainly consider using this with carbotaxel. I mean, you know, if we go back to it, the original basis for this of why 7.5 was not used or 15 was a study that had 30 patients in it. And in each arm, I mean, the original randomized phase 2 trial. And those studies are very valuable. It provided the signal to go forward for this. But I think it's hard to say that that study was what was going to give you necessarily the right dose. And I mean, I think in particular, when now you have a study that involved hundreds of patients and shows really no difference, this doesn't surprise me that there's a plateau in efficacy.
So how have you been approaching the management of patients in the first line setting up until the AVAIL data was presented, and how are you going to approach it now?
Well, I've held fairly closely to the 4599 eligibility criteria. I mean, I think that, number one, study was very real. I know we had these discussions, you know, and some previous things where people said, oh, well, they were concerned because of the neutropenic fever, the hemoptysis. But again, viewing this in the aggregate, patients did better. They lived longer. And so if you had a patient who was eligible for that, then we do approach them about the use of bevacizumab. And I have used pretty much exactly as was used on 4599 with really the only difference in that I tend to use less cytotoxic chemotherapy. I will use 4 cycles, not 6. And I base that on the fact that I think there's pretty compelling evidence that pushing the cytotoxics does not aid you after 4 courses of therapy. So again, I mean, like I said, I'm evidence-based, but here and there one can do an induction, and I could certainly be criticized, but I think that that's a reasonable approach and it's well tolerated.
Before you talk about what you are going to do now that you've seen these data, what have you observed? I don't know how many patients you might have treated with this regimen. Any sort of anecdotal observations, either in terms of efficacy, tolerability, any sort of clinical pearls?
I think that it's very tolerable. You know, you do get some hypertension issues. We have certainly had some patients now who are on maintenance bevacizumab for a period of time. But again, I'm always wary of anecdote. I mean, I can think of anecdotes back when I was using cisplatin and etoposide. There's always somebody who does very well. And that's, you know, I think probably the major thrust of the meeting looking forward is to try to figure out who those folks are.
Have you had any patients with hemoptysis?
No. What I have seen, and what actually was a very important reanalysis of 4599 that was presented, I think this was by Dr. Romalingam, I believe, was looking at the elderly. And that, I think, was really interesting because I have seen this enormous fatigue and problems that the very elderly, the over sort of 70, 75 group with Avastin do tend to get a lot of problems with this. And I think that what he presented was that that group doesn't seem to get quite the survival advantage and seem to get more toxicity. So it may be that that's a group that we need to be cautious about this drug.
Now, what kind of toxicity?
As I recall from his poster, there was more myelosuppression, more fatigue, and I can't remember about hemoptysis.
And you talked about fatigue, but any sort of intuitive clinical explanation about why these people would have more fatigue when they're older?
I don't know.
I mean, do you see...
We check their thyroids, you know, and things like that. Occasionally you'll find that.
Because that's, you know, the impression that I've come away with in terms of Bev alone.
Yeah.
From multiple tumors is relatively minimal impact on quality of life.
By itself, Bev is well tolerated, but added to chemotherapy, there's no question it does increase toxicity.
So when you've seen fatigue in these older patients, is it just while they're getting the chemo and that goes away when they're on the Bev?
Yeah, I mean, we just had a patient quite recently with this and we're just going to have to stop it. So I'm not going to continue Bev. You know, I'm just going to switch him over to a standard regimen. And would I continue Bev later? That's actually an interesting question. Again, we haven't had many of these and they've tended to be in the very elderly. I mean, I've not treated the elderly, including the very elderly, the over 80 group, any different than younger patients. And you tend, when you switch a regimen, to sort of drop that. But I like to get my 4 courses of a platinum-based therapy in. Whether I should pick up Bev again as a maintenance later, that's an interesting question. I haven't done it. Maybe quite reasonable to do that.
So now that you've seen the AVAIL data, what's your approach going to be in the first-line metastatic setting?
I think I would adapt. Well, first, how would I say it? I think at this point, one could still think about this, and I think reasonable people could certainly differ. I probably will go down to the 7.5 dose. I am certainly interested in seeing the final survival data or the overall survival data. Hopefully that'll be presented in Seoul at the World Meeting this fall. But I think that I'm reasonably convinced that the 7.5 gives you all the bounce as the 15.
Which chemo regimen?
I would use it with carbotaxol still. I mean, and then, again, depending upon the nature of the patient, I think cisplatin gemcitabine is also quite validated. Clearly, there were no other major problems with it. And, you know, we'll have more safety data in the next, probably by next year, with other regimens such as carbogem as well, which I think is a much easier regimen for most people to take. I mean, there the major concern was thrombocytopenia along with this. But the bleeding issue has not been very great.
So what is it that's getting you to use carbotaxol?
Because that's a regimen that's generally acceptable in the United States for most people. I mean, cisplatinum is still a relatively difficult drug to employ. I certainly use cisplatinum in stage 1 and 2 disease in the adjuvant setting. I believe it is a somewhat better drug than carboplatinum. I would not criticize anyone for using it in stage four, but I still do find that it is a more toxic agent. And, you know, stage four, your goals are different. I mean, quality of life is very important. And I think at the end of the day, if patients are not coming back to get that four courses of therapy, you're probably doing them a disservice. And carboplatin, if it has 85 or 90% of the efficacy of CIS, you're going to get your four cycles in. It's easy to give. It's simple. I think maybe younger patients, this plan would certainly be justified.
What about docetaxel in this situation?
In what? In frontline stage four disease?
Mm-hmm, with Bev.
I don't use it. Certainly, I don't think carbo-docetaxel has any great advantages. Cisplatin docetaxel, that's actually kind of my favorite regimen in the adjuvant setting. With Bev, I wouldn't criticize it. I mean, it would be, if we were like, you know, you brought up breast cancer before, if lung cancer doctors could, or lung cancer trials could accrue as many patients as the breast cancer trials are able to accrue, that would be quite a reasonable question. I mean, you know, if you look at it, breast cancer physicians can compare Taxol versus Taxotere and 3,000 patients. And those studies, I mean, sometimes they're just fine-tuning things, but there's a value to that. And I think that's a very legitimate question. We just will never know the answer because we'll never do those kinds of studies.
How do you approach therapy of patients who don't meet the criteria, squamous or, you know, so a little hemoptysis, et cetera?
Yeah, I like the carboplatin gemcitabine regimen. We certainly have a number of clinical trials. I mean, obviously, everything I've said is for the patient who either is not eligible or not willing to go on a clinical trial. I think that that's, as I was talking with a friend of mine in the hallway the other day and saying, well, you know, we have all of these leads, you know, which one should we pursue? And I said, nothing that I've seen gives you a 25% complete response rate. Until I start to see something like that, these are all incremental approaches, and I think that there's a number of things one can do. I like the carboplatin gemcitabine regimen a lot.
So for both of those pathways, the Bev or non-Bev first-line metastatic pathway, how do you approach second-line therapy?
For second-line therapy, if the patient has been a smoker, a recent smoker, any reasonably significant history of smoking, I go to Alimta. If they're obviously fit in the demographic of the never smoker, the, you know, adeno CA with BAC, again, in the absence of trials, then I would go with erlotinib. Having said that, you know, I've been very impressed that while some patients really get enormous benefit out of erlotinib, that's a minority, even in that very selected group. I mean, it's actually been somewhat disappointing in that I've had patients who were absolute never smokers, met all the criteria, give them erlotinib, they get florid rash that supposedly predicts things, and their disease just marches right through it.
I mean, I guess we would expect, what, a 50% response rate, theoretically, based on the literature?
Yeah, probably a little lower than that. I mean, I think, you know, maybe 50% in that enriched population. But, you know, there's response rate, which is shrinkage, and then there's also stability. But then there's also the fact that in a lot of these patients, and we're talking that they don't get past 4 or 6 weeks, you know, that they're coming in and they're just progressing, if anything, more rapidly, and they just don't seem to get any benefit.
I mean, I don't know if you have enough people in your practice to kind of compare what you would see using erlotinib in an enriched population second line as opposed to, for example, Alimta.
You know, we just don't know. What we have found, we've seen a couple, and, you know, this is a good hypothesis-generating anecdote, and we're looking back retrospectively at this, is we've had the patients, you know, we know a lot about giving erlotinib in third line. We know nothing about what happens after erlotinib failures and giving chemotherapy. So we've had a couple of cases of patients who would receive Alimta after erlotinib failure who then had fairly dramatic responses, not what you expect in third line, and some of them quite durable. So who knows? You know, and again, I'm not a biologist who can speculate on all the pathways that we may or may not be upregulating in that situation.
What about first-line therapy in the PS2 patient? There was a poster discussion here about erlotinib in that situation. How do you approach those patients in general?
I approach those patients by giving them a dose-attenuated platinum-based regimen. We actually had a poster on this also. I have found the carboplatin gemcitabine regimen to be extremely well-tolerated. We've done that either the two drugs by themselves, or we actually had this planned sequential approach to then weekly Taxol. This is well-tolerated. I think there's now a fair amount of evidence that would say that those who doubt the role of platinum in PS2 patients should consider repenting. But between the study that was presented by Obasaju of Carbogem versus Gem in that situation, which really was very, very similar results to those of the sub-analysis, the pre-planned sub-analysis, I would emphasize, of the CLGB study that looked at carbotaxol versus Taxol and showed that, if anything, the PS2 patients probably get the most dramatic degree of benefit from the addition of platinum. Now, why is that so? Why do we have all of this split on it? Well, I think because PS2 is a heterogeneous group. Lung cancer is heterogeneous, while your PS2 is heterogeneous. There are really three groups of patients who end up that we call, in a simplistic way, PS2. There are those whose performance status has decreased as a consequence of their disease. We all see these patients who come in and, you know, they have the family say, this guy was working, doing manual labor 4 weeks ago, and they come in and they say, yeah, now it's pain to get out of, you know, to walk around. I mean, still walking around, doing normal activities, but they're just too fatigued to do anything, or they're weak, they've lost weight. That's one group. Those are the disease result PS2s. You have a second group that's been PS2 for 20 years. They have comorbidities. They never get out of bed to begin with. That's another bunch. And then you have kind of the frail individuals. You know, we all know this. You know, the little lady who looks like they're going to get blown away in the next windstorm. They have poor muscle mass and stuff, and they're doing fine until they don't. And I think that those latter two groups, the ones who have significant comorbidities and frail patients, that those patients, when they get the two-drug regimen, tend not to do very well because, for one reason or another, it aggravates their pre-existing comorbidity. Now they get a little anemic, so they take a fall or whatever.
But
don't benefit.
But you're also assuming, I assume you're also saying that these people have minimal or no tumor-related symptomatology. You think that most of their symptoms are not from the tumor.
Pre-existed. Right. You talk to them, and this was all present for a year before their disease. And then you have that group that's clearly their disease and their symptoms are related very heavily to tumor. That group, I think, really gets a lot of benefit from the addition of a more aggressive therapy. I think they're being undertreated with single drug treatment. Now, the evidence on this is somewhat mixed, but I do believe that probably the best randomized evidence we have justifies the use of a somewhat dose-attenuated approach. And, you know, the reality is that with many of the drugs that we use all the time, the cytotoxics, the dose that we use was developed on causing toxicity. So we have a very circular set of reasoning, you know, in that everybody says, well, cytotoxics cause toxicity, but then we figure out the dose based upon toxicity. So, and we know also that many situations, biologically, you don't have to go to those doses to inhibit the various enzymes, pathways, or damage DNA with those agents. So, for example, there were actually two presentations on increasing dosing of pemetrexed. 900 versus 500. Both situations showed no advantage over 500. So we have a drug that we dose at really non-toxicity or based on MTD data before we had ways of ameliorating the toxicity, which is just as effective. Dave Gandara showed this almost 20 years ago, that with platinum, you know, you could double your dose of platinum, doesn't help you at all. So a lot of times our doses of drugs that we have in our typical regimens don't really probably need to be as high as they were. And we've sort of accepted that we've gone down a little. If you look at the Taxol dose, we're discussing this last night in an advisory board. You know, if you look at it, ECOG went from a carboplatinum dose AUC of 6 and Taxol of 225 per milligram per meter squared in the famous trial by Dr. Schiller that looked at the four arms. And then in the 4599 study, suddenly Taxol's 200 milligram per meter squared. So that would have considered a major deviation if you had done that on the prior study. So we had a more than 10% reduction right there.
So your second two categories of patients with pre-existing and not tumor-related symptomatology, again, non-smoker, or even if they're smoker, what about erlotinib?
Yeah, so what I was saying was that, well, as upfront therapy,
yes, frontline therapy.
I just find that tough to accept. Again, this is an unselected population. You know, a lot of those frail people are frail and they have their comorbidities because they were heavy smokers. And we actually have a study that addresses that. Rogério Lilienbaum presented this last year. I haven't seen the full publication yet.
But that wasn't in an enriched population.
No, it wasn't. It was not. But it was a PS2 population And so I guess if you're saying if they're PS2 and never smoked.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So, well, first off, in the unenriched population, chemotherapy came out significantly better than Tarceva in a study that wasn't even designed to look at that. So in an enriched population, would I do it? Yes, I would. But let's also understand that Tarceva is just like other drugs, which is that the patients with PS2 also don't do well. If you look for predictors of activity for Tarceva, they do better with better performance status. So it's like everything else.
The last thing I want to ask you, we don't have too much time, but I know it could take like an hour to go through this, but let's just cut to the chase, is getting back to adjuvant therapy. A couple questions just to follow up on things we've talked about before, just to see whether anything's changed over the last year or so. First of all, you mentioned the fact that you generally like to go with cis docetaxel as your adjuvant therapy. What's the rationale?
Well, I think that the weight of data is for a cisplatin-based regimen. If one wants to be completely data-driven, then there's cisplatin vinorelbine. You know, no question that that's probably the most validated regimen out there. But it's difficult to give. Even the people who use that were advocating, you know, Dr. Shepard, I believe, presented last year sort of an alternative vinorelbine regimen. And, you know, in stage 4 disease, and again, here's where the shackles of evidence at times need to be a little bit loosened, is in certainly in stage 4 disease, cisplatin docetaxel is at least as good, possibly superior, probably better tolerated than cisplatin vinorelbine. And so I think that that's a very reasonable regimen. If somebody told me they were going with cisplatin vinorelbine, I would not argue about it. Cisplatin gemcitabine, very reasonable. I think the crucial drug in this is platinum. And for that matter, carboplatin, I think, despite all of the arguments, and we could fight from now till doomsday, I think is also reasonable. I think that the one study, I mean, as was pointed out yesterday, to really do a totally, truly powered stage 1B study, you need about 2,000 patients. And so you had a probably underpowered study that showed an improvement in progression-free survival. If you subgrouped out the 4-centimeter patients, those people, you know, are greater. They clearly did better. I don't think carboplatin is inactive in the setting. Occasionally, we do that. Why? Because there are some patients who simply will not tolerate a cisplatin-based therapy. It is not unusual for us to start with a cisplatin-based therapy, have a patient after one or two cycles simply cannot tolerate that, and switch them for their final couple cycles to a carboplatin-based therapy.
And I can tell you, as of really like about a month ago, when we did our most recent patterns of care study, that the numbers that we're seeing in oncologists in practice are by far still today dominant therapies, carboplatin, about half of all adjuvant is the preferred regimen of about half of oncologists. And then the other three are kind of equally split. That also brings up the issue of the 1B situation, hearkening back to a year ago. We talked about it at that time. How are you approaching those patients right now?
Well, what I do is I look at the, you know, 1B is heterogeneous, and we will probably never have the study in this situation. And here's where I think subgroup analysis does help you. Particularly, rumor has it that I believe the Canadians looked at their results and found very similar data in stage 1B, that the greater than 4-centimeter patients got a significant advantage. And we've known this for many years, and there were a couple of abstracts presented at this meeting that looked at size of tumor and prognosis. And we know that in 1B, there's the patients who just have tumor that's touching pleura are different from those who have a 3-centimeter or different from 4 and 5. So it's a continuum, and I think that it's a benefit and risk. And so I think below 4 centimeters and the ones that just have it on the 1B on the basis of small tumors involving that are peripheral and involve pleura, I don't use adjuvant chemotherapy. One needs to understand that there's no perfection in that group of patients either, that they're still at risk. And hopefully we'll have trials that will address this, such as the upcoming CALGB study that will look at molecular signatures and then randomize to chemotherapy or not based on that.
In the adjuvant setting?
In the adjuvant setting for stage 1A and the selected 1Bs.
Wow, that's a good
Dr.
one.
Harpole will lead that, yes.
When's that starting?
Well, that, shall we say, all depends upon the folks at CTEP and Bethesda.
Wow,
it's been sort of floating and aging delicately there for a while.
So they're going to take the lower risk patients, and what kind of testing are they going to do?
This was a very nice publication by the Duke group in New England Journal of Medicine within the last year. And so you take that and you can stratify these patients into those who are at real low risk, in other words, that are just not going to relapse, versus those who have a significant risk of relapse, because realize that even 1A patients have a 20% risk of relapse. So obviously you either do or you don't, and it looks from their methodology that you can potentially isolate those out. Now, the fact that we can identify that something bad will happen doesn't necessarily mean we can do something good about it, okay? So then those patients who are the high risk will be randomized to either chemotherapy or observation.
And again, what kind of marker or assay is it?
Well, it's what they call a metagene analysis, so it's not relying on a single gene. I think this is where a lot of the field is going, is you have the one group that's looking, you know, or one approach of signatures is sort of a global approach. You know, we take these sets of patients, we figure out who does well, who doesn't, figure out what their signature is, then use another set of specimens to validate that, then a third set to cross-validate, and there are various statistical ways of doing this so that you end up being able to clearly enrich and reproducibly enrich for this, versus the other approach would be to say, okay, we've isolated out four or five specific genes that we understand, and then this can identify those groups. And I think both of them are potentially valid. You know, we'll see what goes forward, but I think both approaches are going to lead to adjuvant studies in the near future.
And I hope you're going to tell me that that trial is going to let you do dealer's choice chemo.
I think it allows you from a selection of regimens, as I recall.
Does that include carboplatin?
I don't recall. I probably not. You know? I mean, should it? Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, again, there are these arguments that one has to realize that the nature of these studies is that they're made in committee, you know, and it's always an ordeal.
Well, you know, I was telling the ECOG people, you know, Joan Schiller and Heather Wakely and Alan Sandler, and I don't know if you realize that there's something kind of analogous going on in breast cancer and HER2-positive disease, which is the NSABP and BCRG. Are all sold on a non-anthracycline regimen, the TCH that was just reported, and they want to do TCH plus or minus Bev. You know, it's kind of similar, but people in practice aren't using TCH, and so they're going to allow the Adria in there, but it's going to be powered to look at the TCH. But it's kind of a similar thing where you have the researchers saying one thing, and then the people in practice are doing something else.
Well, you know, I don't see this vast divide. I mean, I know that there are certainly people in academic medicine who do a variety of things that I don't particularly agree with, and there are people out in the real world of practice, which I've done myself for several years when I was in the military, and they're very, very much adhering to the evidence and in some ways sometimes more academic than the academics. So I think it's all over the place. I think the problem is that when you go to the trials, there are other things that you're looking at, and it's not just necessarily even the single academic question, but sometimes with a new drug, it's also what will be an approach that will potentially result in the licensure of that drug for that indication. And so we have FDA considerations, and that's a whole other set of issues.
Yeah, but there's also getting stuff done.
Yeah.
And
yes,
you know, that's
absolutely
what gets me worried, because I think that the adjuvant Bev question obviously is compelling.
It's been delayed for a year over nonsense. I completely agree. I don't see any reason why that wasn't there, and one could simply make sure that your randomizations were balanced and you analyze for these variables. But I don't think carboplatin is an ineffective regimen in the adjuvant setting. It may not be the perfect regimen, but somebody once told me, you know, when it comes to like a lot of things, perfect is the enemy of good.
The other thing is it's frustrating for the investigators is they want to get the trial done and they know what the practical
issues. I mean, we've been waiting for this for a year now. We were ready to open it up a year. We haven't had an adjuvant study now.
Well, at least it's open now, I guess, as of a couple of days ago.
Yeah,
it actually is open. So we'll see. I mean, it's exciting. I just hope the trial can get done.
I think it will.
Think so?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of enthusiasm for the question. And I think there's enough American oncologists who will be willing in a situation like this to use cisplatinum for that adjuvant segment. I mean, I think that there's a good argument to use cisplatinum adjuvantly.
Also, same thing happened with the CO8, you know, colon trial of adjuvant Bev, that I mean, the docs in practice were excited about offering their patients the possibility of maybe improved outcome. So I think that same dynamic may be a whole true here.
And the difference now in the adjuvant setting in lung cancer is for the very first time, there's no therapy control arm.
Right.
Everybody gets treated. This is a landmark change in lung cancer.